racing is racing, and there is always some weird thing that happens.
Okay, so welcome to It's Not the Car, the only motorsport podcast that makes its own gravy. Except that gravy has tapered shim stacks and a digressive force curve. And if you know what I mean, you probably shouldn't have too much of it if guests are coming over for dinner or you have to give a big speech for work or something. I don't know. I'm Sam Smith. I'm a journalist and a club racer. I have a new book out this month. It's an anthology of my writing about cars over the last 20 years. It's called Smithology. It's available on Amazon. Jeff, who are you?
I'm Jeff Brown. I'm a race engineer, competition director for an IMSA team this year, and I can't wait to read Sam's book.
That's your first mistake. Ross, who are you?
I'm Ross Bentley, and I do not have a new book out this month. But I did write one once, and but I also drove an Indy car way back in the early 90s and drove some other cars and then coach people that drive those kinds of things. So I'm having fun.
Don't fib, Ross. You've written like 4,000 books. I've read at least three of them. I really enjoy them.
I bet
that's
you.
That's what I was going to say. When he said he doesn't have a book coming out this month, I'm like, really? You don't? What's wrong?
It's a lie. So many lies.
It can't be true.
Okay. So we switch formats every episode in the show, mostly because our producer, Mike, is a very young man and the brains of young people are like sharks. If they don't stay active, they sink and die. We want to keep them afloat. Now, this format, the one we're using in this episode, it's what we call our monthly centerpiece. It's where I snort a bunch of coffee grounds like Stevie Nicks in the 70s and 80s, and I do this long, quick take, compressed share of an epic story from racing history. And then when I'm done, Jeff and Ross and I, we break it all down and pull apart why it's bonkers and what it means now. So today's story, it's a good one. This is a story of an engine built in total secrecy in an eye blink in order to give the middle finger to a whole lot of people. And like all engine stories, it's a story really of the people who did the work and why, and what that work did to the people and why those people thought that work was important, which sounds kind of more boring than it is. But really, this is a great story because it's got Paul Treacy melting his feet off and there's a bunch of things blowing up and Mario Andretti sits on his front porch giving the stink eye across town at one point. It's just, there's so much going on. And yeah, I love it. You guys good if I dive into this?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Sam. We make this show because we like it, but also because it keeps our young producer, Mike, off the street and away from a life of crime. If you want to help both of those things happen, your luck. We have this thing called Patreon. For a few bucks a month, you get to help support the show, but you also get some neat perks like monthly bonus episodes. The money we raise through Patreon helps keep this show on the air. If you like what you're getting here and want to help us keep doing it, that'd be great. If not, that's fine too. We like you anyway. You're here. We're glad. Join at patreon.com/notthecar. Back to the show. So fair warning here. Ross and Jeff, we were talking about this before we started taping. They've given me the okay. I like this story a lot. I love this story. So they said it was okay if I go a little longer with my breakdown of the thing and maybe even slow down from the standard pace so I don't give myself a heart attack. And what you should take away from all that is that they are, what's the word? Suckers. Or, you know, like 20 minutes in, they're going to realize that this episode has another 20 hours to go and we're going to kill the show dead and they'll never let me do it again. Either way, it sounds like fun to me. So, 3, 2, 1. Here we go. We have a guy named Mario, a Swiss engineer. He's born in 1949. He loves racing as a kid. Motor racing has been banned in Switzerland since 1955. He is 6 years old at that point. This happens because the Swiss are a fun people. They wear lampshades on their heads at parties, or maybe it's the opposite. But regardless, Mario, he can't shake his love for this stuff. He follows the career of Joe Bonnier, the Swedish F1 driver. He's an expat living in Switzerland. He works for Bonnier when he's younger doing car prep. He gets out of school. He's an engineer doing diesel diesel and truck work for a bit, but he loves motorsport. In 1979, at the age of 30, he quits his job. He moves to England. He goes to work for Cosworth. At that point, Cosworth is the center of the racing engine development world. He spends 5 years there. He meets a guy named Paul Morgan. Paul is a British engineer. He's good with manufacturing. Now, both of these guys believe in people. Both of them treat job interviews like personal chats. They thought culture mattered as much as everything, as anything, but also they believed in letting employees be people and making their own decisions and removing structure. And in the early 80s, they figure, screw it. They decide to start a company. They sit down. They write this ballsy pitch letter to a guy named Roger Penske, proposing a new company to design and build turbocharged engines for IndyCar. Now, the way they do this, there's a handwritten letter. They make this letter out with their wives. They have no copier. They have no way to keep a copy of this letter. So they take pictures of it as a record before they send it out. Roger bites on it. A contract is signed on November 22nd of 1983, which doesn't sound interesting. What's interesting about that is like Penske's like, we get into business, all the business in here. My name is Roger, and I like good ideas, and I like money. And here I see both. Now, Roger, if you don't know him, we've talked about him here before. He's a former driver. He's a good one. He has businesses and a racing team that to date has dozens of championships across almost every pro series you can name. Right now, he has 19 wins at the Indy 500. So Mario and Paul, they get some money from Roger. They name their company Ilmor after their last names, Mario Illin, Morgan, Paul Morgan, not Morgan Paul. That's a weird name. They get some backing from GM and Chevrolet. They make an engine for IndyCar. Its first race is in 86. The first win comes a year later with Mario Andretti in 87. And that race breaks this crazy, crazy long win streak at Cosworth, their old employer had been on. It was something like 84 wins that engine had had, because the Ilmor Chevy, the thing that they build, is just bonkers good. It's smart and it's compact and it's evolutionary. And where Cosworth had been running Cosworth had been running this evolution of an engine they'd built since the 60s for Formula One. The Ilmor just cleans up. It wins like 70% of the races over the next 6 years, 5 IndyCar championships, 6 Indy 500s. And this is where it gets interesting, because the Indy 500, as we've talked about before on this show, it's a thing, it's a deal. And at this point, there are two basic ways when it comes to engines that you can go to the Indy 500. You could buy or build yourself a pure racing engine, every part in the thing purpose-built for the job. Or you could run what they called a stock block, this thing based on a production car cylinder block with push rods, meaning it didn't have overhead cams. There's one cam, it's in the block, and these little metal sticks come off the cam, like in a small block Chevy. They go up, they actuate rockers off the cam, it opens valves, and yada, 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 monkey motion. It looks like, it's a lot simpler than it sounds, but it goes, it's not as sexy as the racing engine that does the racing engine thing. Now, you'd think that one of these engines would be cheaper to go racing with than the other. And you'd be right, sort of. You'd also think that it would be more apt to go the distance, be successful. And, you know, you'd be right about that, too. And it was usually the one designed for the purpose. Now, both of these engine types were turbocharged. And the cheap one, the stock block thing, that practice was invented by the rulemakers to help fill up the field. And to try and fair things up, because when you have a stock block engine and then you have this thing that was spun up like magic science off the shelf, one of them's going to be stronger. So to fair it up, they made allowances in the rules. And this is the really important part. So listen up. If you ran a purpose-built racing engine at the Indy 500, you were limited to 2.6 liters and a certain amount of boost to keep power down. If you ran the stock block rig, you got 50% more displacement and 22% more boost, which, if I've done my math right, is a lot of boost. So you could build yourself, basically, a 3.6 liter boom gun running a lot of cylinder pressure, except it was still kind of going to be a Stone Age motor, and in this case, often a Buick V6, and they often went boom more often than they went gun. So those rules, the thing is, they screwed with the rules a lot. And as those rules evolved, one of the things they started letting you do with the pushrod engines was make up your own block from scratch to help it survive the abuse. So Mario and Paul, our boys, they figure out this is a thing. And they realize they could basically build their own whiz-bang pushrod engine from scratch, but they figure they make it internally like one of the other big, sexy purebred engines, otherwise all engineered to the moon. And that lets them run the big displacement and that big fat boost. And they are smart. They do the math. They realize, hell, man, that could be at least like 50, maybe 75 horsepower. And that's a lot anywhere, but it's also a lot at Indy. Now, the thing is, those numbers end up being fun low, like real fun low. But we'll get to that moment. So it's 1993. Mario and Paul are looking at the 94 500. New manufacturers like Honda are coming in, announcing they're coming into IndyCar. Mara and Paul know that if they're going to do anything with this weird little like rule loophole they got to move fast. Their jobs are going to get harder, more competition every day as things change. And they also know that if anyone gets wind of this engine they're doing, this thing that shouldn't exist, this thing that, frankly, if the rulemakers found out about, they'd probably just leak all over their pants. If anyone gets wind of that, the thing's going to be banned. They meet Penske. They tell him. They pitch him. Penske asked Mario about power. Mario's like, I don't know, 900, 940. Current engines at the time, they made like 750, 760. Penske's like, are you sure about this? And Alien's like, I am absolutely sure. I'm convinced of it because Sam cannot do a Swedish accent. I sound like a total jerk right now, but that's fine. And Penske says, send it. First blueprints are drawn up on July 19th. The race is less than a year away. They have an entire new engine to build from nothing. And I mean absolute nothing. Maybe they'll take some stuff from the bottom end of the old IndyCar engine, the one they'd been using before, but nothing. They have to test it and prep it for 500 miles, nearly flat out running some of the craziest engine abuse on the planet in all of racing, and to get it all started. The testing has to start in January. The engine has to be running by January. The race is in May. And they do not have near enough time, but they know it is happening anyway. And they say, yes, they're going to do it. And the whole time, they have to also prep and develop and test the other IndyCar engine. Because remember, this engine is only for the 500. The thing is, the push rod is only going to be used for one race, the 500. Secrecy is bonkers. Suppliers are given code names. Penske's facilities are locked down from October to May. No one from the outside is allowed in. They run compulsory 70 or 80 hour work week, 7 a.m. to 9 o'clock at night. No choice, but really that's just the beginning. That's a dip in the pool of what they have to put in. Ilmor becomes like the CIA in terms of hush hush cloak and dagger stuff. Everybody's on salary. There's no overtime pay. They're working literally constantly for months, and all they all wanted to do it. All of them, they desperately wanted to do it. Some of them left at 2 or 3 in the morning and would show back up at 8 o'clock, especially at Ilmor, because Morgan was like, well, you know, I mean, we start at 8. Guys, if you want to stay until 3 or 4, you can, but we start at 8. And people were like, mm-hmm, yeah. And they kept staying until 3 or 4 in the morning. And only a handful of people know the whole picture. It was bonkers. Now, the math here is interesting, right? To make the power they needed big RPM, like 10,000 RPM. To make big RPM, they needed small parts that were stable and moved fast and remain stable and strong for long periods. Because Indy is a long race, and push rods are pretty much not where you go when you want that kind of thing. They come up with this valve drive arrangement that uses really short push rods, look like two wooden spoons tossed in a bucket with some more wooden spoons, and random top end parts and springs, and there were no right angles in the whole thing. The top of the engine, the timing was so short, everything was so condensed that they had to design the top of the engine before the bottom was built and tested. They made bench rigs to test this stuff. Just open, lashed up homebrew setups with hot oil spraying everywhere, pools on the floor and on the ceiling and getting on people's shoes. They didn't have time to do real testing to actually go through the proper way to figure these things out. So they just sat there poking at it faster and faster and faster on the bench, this little rig running the valve gear until smoke came out of it and blew up. And then they'd pull the whole thing apart, redesign another part, throw more parts back in it, watch for more smoke. They did this for months on end. The valves were enormous, right? They're going to make 800 horsepower, 900 horsepower, whatever it is. They're going to be big. Well, it had to be a two-valve motor. They were made by a racing supplier in California that made almost everybody else's valves in the business, a place they couldn't control. They knew word would get out, right? They knew somebody would look at those valves and go, holy hell, what's happening? Penske's doing something. So that much air being moved, they thought, okay, well, what else has giant valves? Well, Penske has a NASCAR team. So they labeled the drawings for Penske's Pontiac NASCAR team. Nobody suspected a thing. Testing went on and on and on. Ilmor wasn't familiar with push rods. Parts failed constantly. They were fighting weird resonant frequencies where the whole thing came apart. Places where it wasn't happy, it would run happily at full honk, but not at yellow flag speeds and chew itself to bits. All kinds of stuff goes wrong. We get to September. The race is in May, remember? And they have to run it in January. It's critical. At this point, things are kind of sort of looking like it's going to happen. And to make a long story short, that's when the money goes away. General Motors was still backing Ilmor, right? At that point, they're having a rough go in the rest of their business. They figure, okay, screw it. We're going to pull the money away from Ilmor. They did this in a really dickish way. They basically bid Ilmor really low for next year's budget, knowing Ilmor was going to say no and turn down the budget. And that's what happened. And the next day after Ilmor turns it down, GM announces they're pulling out of IndyCar racing with Chevrolet to chase, and I'm quoting here, mainstream development and marketing, which is like saying you're going to, It's a middle finger on top of a middle finger on top of a middle finger. Now, the thing that I didn't tell you earlier was that Ilmor had just come off a kind of gross year. Just these unpaid bills from clients in F1 and other places. They're kind of strapped. They're thin. If they don't find the money like now, it might kill the company. It might, let alone the engine. Engine goes bye-bye. Company goes bye-bye. I don't know. Mario and Paul go back to living on the street, working at whatever the Swiss equivalent of McDonald's is. Wait, it's probably McDonald's. That makes sense. So Penske. He knows everybody. He's known everybody forever. He pulls a Hail Mary. He calls in some friends at Mercedes-Benz. Mercedes is in the middle of this glorious motorsport resurgence. We could and will do an entire show on that period. But to make a long story short, in November, early November, they ink a deal. The contract is a handful of pages. GM's contract had been like a phone book. And Mercedes and Omar are pals for seasons to come, and the engine is branded a Mercedes. But at that point, it's still not really a thing, right? This monkey motion, magic, tiny thing, watch parts in it that was actually monstrous by racing standards. They nicknamed it Beast. It finally is running. It is running 6 months and one day after the first drawing, 26 weeks, 185 days, which is like saying, well, we needed this Eiffel Tower built by Tuesday and it was Thursday. And then, you know, we did it. Well, okay, right. They fire it up on the dyno, makes pretty decent torque. They're all pretty happy. There's an Ilmor habit or tradition to just pop champagne in the dyno room. They're dense in the ceiling from all the corks over the seasons. And they look at it and they grind and cry. And, oh, it's not making enough power. It makes 850 horse. And the engine they've been using, the one this thing's supposed to blow out of the water, it's 820. They call RP, they call Penske, they call the captain, they call the dude up and they're like, hey, buddy. Oh, and Roger is like, that's not enough. We need 900. And this is not what Roger sounds like, but this is what Roger sounds like in my head. Things were still a problem. They had problems with elasticity of the valve train, all these things moving and stretching, these tiny little push rods, small enough to bend, fit in your palm, stainless steel push rods bending at the RPM needing. Still couldn't sort it. And yet they had to keep building engines. Test engines were built in secret at Penske's Pennsylvania facility. These three guys, an old dark, dingy automatic transmission shop down the street from the main race shop to avoid suspicion. This converted place where they had been storing tires. They'd get to that garage in order to keep anybody from knowing. They'd get to the garage at 6 in the evening, tear down an engine, wash it, rebuild it until midnight, put it on a crate, load it into a box truck, drive it down the street to the dyno at the main shop with the tools and the bell housing for the dyno and the exhaust and everything, run the dyno, and at the end of the night and early morning at wee dark hours, pack it up, no trace, clean everything to make it look like they hadn't been there, and then take it all home. The thing starts doing okay. Made so much power at one point. This is great. I love this story. I love this story so much. Seizes a piston pin on the dyno. And the wrist pin connects the piston to the connecting rod. The force turns the piston sideways in the jug, in the cylinder. The side skirt of the piston is now on top, facing the valves. Ran like 10 seconds like that on the dyno. They didn't realize it initially because it barely hurt the horsepower figure it was putting out. The guys look into it. They do a bore scope on it. One of the guys is like, dude, come here, look at it. They look down it. The guy looks down the plug hole. He's like, that's the side of the piston. It's not the top. This is what we're dealing with. It's monster thing. First test on the track is set for February 20th. It's a Sunday. They go to Nazareth, Pennsylvania, home of the Andretti's. There's a speedway there, a 1 mile oval. Michael and Mario, the Andretti's, live a mile or so from the track. Now, keep in mind, this thing is still secret. It hasn't turned a single wheel under its own power. And so they start planning. It's snowy in Pennsylvania. They send handwritten drawings to the staff of the speedway on how to clear snow off the speedway, how off the track surface, how to plow it, how to make. There are 10-foot walls of snow on the side of the track that they then have the staff spray with water so it'll turn to ice to keep the snow from falling down. The first day, it's 41 degrees. They just want to go out there and log mild. The car is in primer. It's gray and black and white, and it looks like something that rolled out of, I don't know, a barn somewhere. They'd warm it on the dyno the night before, then install it in the car and get it crazy hot because Nazareth was an hour away from Penske's shop, and if it cooled too much, it wouldn't want to start when it got there. So they got it just stinking, smoking hot, took it there, and then pray that it fired. They'd get space heaters on barrels of fuel so the fuel pump didn't freeze up, and then every morning at 8 o'clock, they'd start and run, you know, that first day, 150 miles testing. Put a second engine in, 10-lap shakedown. Unser gets out of it. They had Al Unser Jr. in it testing it. It says it's got a lot of power, sounded lower and throatier. It's spitting flames. It's running so rich. It's circulating on an ice-cold track with walls of ice in an unproven engine that could at any moment lock up and put little Al on the wall. And their main thing is like, man, I really hope Mario and Michael don't hear it. And the thing is, this is also part I love. Mario's later was like, Yeah, absolutely. I could hear it. The noise was very different. I knew it was a secret test. Mario was like, yeah, those assholes are over there doing something. What is it? I don't know. Things were still coming apart. There was so much break, fix, break, fix, break, fix, break, fish, re-engineer, cam followers were redesigned. Everything kept going back and forth and back and forth. At one point, there were so many parts going back and forth. Keep in mind, they're still working basically 24 hours. Ilmor's facility was in England. Penske was in America. So, you know, work never stopped. And at one point, they got so tight on schedules and things getting back and forth across the Atlantic that they started putting parts in the Concorde and somebody would just hand carry them across the Atlantic. Testing continues. Paul Tracy is still in the car in 20-degree weather in a snowmobile suit driving the thing. His feet get frozen after 30 or 50 laps. They'd bring him in, put heat guns on it, melt his shoes because he couldn't feel it. His feet were so numb, he couldn't feel it. They had to redesign the gearbox because the engine's torque was shattering bearings. Just gnarly stuff, man. April comes along, races in May. Handful of people at Mercedes know about the engine, and one of them is the director of motorsport there, but basically it's still massively secret. Things keep going wrong. They've covered more than 2,500 miles in testing. They can't get the thing to last more than 500 miles. This keeps popping shit internally. They schedule the car's unveiling to the public announcement for April 13th, this really confident news conference. They're like, still blowing up. The industry loses its mind. People are saying things going to make 800 horse or a million. It's going to go 260 miles an hour on the straights. More, it's going to collapse the earth, make it fall into the moon. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Everybody's just like, we're all screwed. And everyone knows the rule loophole is going to be closed after the race. But here's the thing. They make it work. They figure out how to stick the landing on it. The race happens. 500 starts. Emerson Fittipaldi and Al Unser Jr. are driving. There are two cars, two engines. MO sets the fastest lap of the month in practice. It's 230 flipping miles an hour, nearly 3 miles an hour faster than the other purebred race engine cars in the field. That's an eternity at Indy. Al Unser Jr., little Al qualifies in the pole. In the race, he and MO just utterly wipe the floor with the rest of the field. They check the hell out. They lap the field. Unser takes the lead on lap 184 when MO touches the wall in turn four. Only one other driver in the entire field finishes on the lead lap. There was this massive push to run one race. Millions of dollars, a loophole for a minute. All these people believing the thing was important, and it became important because of that. And we haven't seen anything at all like it since. Okay, this isn't the Sam show, so I'm not going to talk for the rest of the episode.
Can I ask you guys a question?
No.
Yeah.
Do you think it was a loophole? Like, do you consider that a loophole?
Interesting. Okay, unpack that. What do you mean?
Well, like a loophole almost sounds like you're cheating. Like you're skirting the rules. But really, to me, I mean, the rules were there. Like it was wide open to anybody. The difference is that maybe somebody not as smart as Mario Illion and Paul Morgan read the rule book. And didn't really, like, Jeff, I know, I mean, this is up your alley. Like, was it borderline cheating? Was it just a loophole? Was it just somebody was smarter to read the rule book the way they did?
That's a great question. And I always say in rules, there's gray areas, there's cheating, there's gray areas, there's loopholes. And the other part of a rule is what I think this was. It was not a loophole. It was certainly not cheating. It was certainly against the, and rules makers will use this, and I hate it, but it was against the spirit and intent of the rule. That doesn't make it illegal. So this, right. To me, the spirit and intent of the stock block rule was to allow, as Sam said, underfunded teams or less funded teams or teams with legacy motors like the Buick that had been around to compete with the purpose-built 4-cam race motors. And so that was the spirit and intent of that. The intent of the rule wasn't to try to drive engine manufacturers like Ilmor or Cosworth to go out and build some crazy pushrod engine that had pushrods just big enough to be called pushrod so it could get within the rule. That wasn't the spirit and intent of that rule. The intent was to allow the older teams with Buicks to enter the race, because if the turbo boost was the same, they wouldn't even enter because they couldn't compete. They probably couldn't qualify. And I think to me, that's really cool. You know, nobody said that you couldn't do that. So loophole or spirit and intent, but that's the way I looked at it. I thought it was brilliant.
Is that the way? So racing has always swung back and forth, like pivot around that fulcrum, right? People taking advantage of the rules, then the rules catch up, then people take advantage of the rules, then the rules catch up. Is that the way it, and should is a dangerous word, but is that the way it should be? Is there a world where motorsport is bettered by a stable rule set that never changes and everybody knows where you can't poke holes in it?
Ross?
what, well, a cheat. Oh, man. Talk about...
My opinion.
You're just like, I'll defer.
I want to go second.
To me, the cool thing about this entire story is it is the people, but it is the fact that there was a time when this could happen.
Yeah.
I don't see that happening now. I just don't see how it could happen now because everything is so specced now. And... you know, on one hand, I go, hey, it's great because, I don't know, last year, the Indy 500, there were like, I don't know, 11 cars on the lead lap at the end of the race or some number. I don't know what it was. Somebody will prove me wrong, but that's the way it is. There were 2 cars on the lead lap, but it was only because of a yellow that there was even that. Like, it would have been 1 car on the lead lap. So from a competition perspective, maybe it's better today, but there's a part of it that just goes, it was so cool when people could look at the rules and go, oh, let's go do that. That's crazy. Let's do it.
Yep. It's, I think nowadays the cost of something like that, because who knows what it cost Penske to do that. It didn't matter to him. And as you said, Sam, the budget kind of went in and out, but Roger was always that backstop. He was going to make it happen. Somehow he would figure it out. The thing is, now there's probably 3, 4, 5 teams that could do the same thing and bring the same budget to bear. So it would just escalate into one of those nuclear arms races things where everybody would end up with the same performance, but at 10x the cost. So, I mean, I don't know that that would work today, but man, it was so cool to be able to see how they did that. And I was involved in a project on a way smaller scale, but was a similar thing. And we just like smoked everybody in this project. And the guys that we beat knew that it was only going to be a one-off thing. It was going to happen 1 year and it was going to go away. And so the guys that we beat were like, holy moly, that is so cool. They thought it was cool because somebody did what they all wished they could do too. And they knew that they weren't going to have to race against that forever and ever. And they just were like, wow, that's cool. Tell us more about it. That's really cool. And nobody wants to lose the Indy 500. But I think most of the teams that got beat by Penske that year went, wow, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Kicked our ass. But man, that was so cool. I wish we could have thought of that, or I wish we could have afforded that. That's cool. And then it went away. They never had a race against it again.
It's such a strange dichotomy, right? Because on the one hand, that's, you know, this sort of thing is exactly what sanctioning bodies and rulemakers don't want. It's exactly what makes for boring racing to watch. You know, after a while, like if that had been allowed to carry on, it would have taken everybody else a long time to catch up. And Penske would have just walked away with race after race after race. But at the same time, like, we're sitting here talking about it because it's deeply compelling stuff. Because everybody, like all we're ever interested in, the reason we watch Indy, the reason we watch sports car racing, the reason we want to be a part of any of it is the moments where people do something extraordinary and push beyond what you think is possible. And, yeah, you know, I've talked to people who were there. I've read a dozen books on the moment, and it's like any other moment in history where something is happening. People get this collective, we're seeing something. What is this? And everybody gets that weird kind of like, the eclipse just happened, right? Like, this is the thing. We're all experiencing the thing and we don't know what it is, but it's there and it's special and your gut hurts. Like, those magical moments in the sport are why we show up, but you can't brew them. You can't plan them. And if you get too many of them, they lose their value, right? It's it's such a weird thing because you don't want to go chasing them. Otherwise, you won't find them.
And maybe some of that why we think it's so cool now is because it can't happen now.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't happen anymore. We live in the world of spec cars, homologation, all of that. And we get good racing, like Ross said, really good competitive racing, but we give up this for that. And I don't know what the right balance is, but it sure is cool to be able to go back and see what these guys did. It was, there's not many people that can do that though. The one thing that I kept on, I read Jade Gruss's book about the Beast book, which is fantastic. If anybody wants to know more about it, go read that. That was excellent. But I kept on, as I was reading that the first time, I didn't really realize it. And I went back before the show to kind of refresh my memory on it. And I kept on coming back to, nobody does this anymore. Nobody, this doesn't happen. And then I thought, you know, actually, maybe it does kind of happen. The whole Elon Musk, love him or hate him, takes the same kind of approach to things that these guys took to this engine. You know, we're going to build a rocket. It's going to blow up a lot. Yeah, that's not a failure. That's how we go better.
Right.
This engine blew up a lot, pieces every place. You know, there's a kaboom and oil leaks out the bottom and they blew it up all the time. But we weren't talking about, we're not talking about now with as sophisticated simulation that we can do stress analysis and CFD of the internal flow of the engine and things like that. These guys didn't have time to do much other than go, this is how we think it works. This is our experience. Let's build it, try it, blow it up, and go again. Kind of like Elon's doing with his rockets.
So Jeff, you talk about the time, and Sam, what was it like? From July to May, so whatever that is, 9-10 months or something like that. So I was there in 94. You know, 93 I had my little issues at Indy. 94 I went back and there was sort of, we're trying to put a sponsorship deals together at the very last moment. I went there, I ran the first week of practice in a 2 or 3 year old chassis and old engines, and you know, basically it was sort of me getting some time on the track, hoping that the sponsorship deal was going to come through and we'd be able to walk down Gasoline Alley and go, we want that car there. And that never happened, but I was on track when they were out there. And I can remember the sound of it. That was the thing that struck me, was just simply, it sounded so much different than everything else. It sounded different than the Buick turbos that I'd been blowing up the year before. but it sounded different. And I'm going to say my big takeaway from the whole thing was, give that same bunch of people, like, well, first of all, give them 3 days of sleep after the Indy 500, because man, I don't know how they all survived that thing. All of them that were working on that project, but give them 3 days of sleep and then give them 6 months to develop that car. I am sure that car would have qualified 8-10 miles an hour faster than everybody else if they'd ever had time to develop the car. But they basically, it was not a great handling car. and they just kind of like, you know, yeah. I mean, they had all sorts of weird things like with it, and they kept fixing things, but there were a bunch of Band-Aids at the last minute. And yeah, they dominated, but they didn't dominate the way they could have. And they had like just a little bit more time.
It's so, you know, you mentioned this earlier, Ross, like the fact that they didn't get all of it, the fact that they didn't get so much of what a Penske program would normally do with anything, right? The whole Penske Perfect thing, where every last detail and every last spreadsheet cell has a spreadsheet cell within it declaring how spreadsheety that spreadsheet cell is, right? You think about that and you think, well, okay, well, I wonder if it drove Roger nuts because it wasn't a Roger program. But at the same time, the other side of that coin is, well, of course it didn't, because it's such a Roger thing to go and back this and do it and put this together. And it's so interesting to me that guy in particular, his whole ethos with all of this is, you know, it's almost like the dude defined what it means to I mean, you don't want to say, well, he was a racer, but it's almost like the dude defined in a lot of ways what it means to look at this stuff the right way, because the things like this would happen and, or have happened or still do happen. You go, yep, that's what you should do. That's exactly how this should work. And it doesn't matter that the entire rest of his career has been other ways of looking at things. This is clearly the way that a person should look at this in that moment. It's funky.
Well, and Sam, to me, the story, what really makes this thing what it is, the whole story of this engine, it's about the people that were behind it and the stuff, you know, you mentioned that Penske and Mario Illion and Paul Morgan, they believed in their people.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I found really interesting was when they were going through those early stages in Ilmore in the UK and they're building these parts and they're like working, I don't know, it sounds like 20-hour days. People are getting no sleep and how they could keep doing that for month after month after month. And to me, the thing is, I'm pretty sure the message was, hey, we're not building this really cool engine. The message was, we are going to go win the Indy 500 and dominate the Indy 500. Everybody that worked in that project, they weren't building cam followers and piston rings and whatever, right? They were going to win the Indy 500. And I think that's the big picture. That's the thing that Penske, I think, is famous for, is he can motivate people to do what they didn't think they were possible of doing. And it's, you know, I mean, you can kind of look at, does Musk do that? Did Steve Jobs do that? Did, you know, I mean, people like that have through history have done that kind of thing. But I think that's the thing, is the message was, we are going to go and destroy everybody at Indy. And that made people work 20 hours a day with no sleep for hours or for months on end. That's what made it happen.
And you have to build that into the culture, right? You know, the Illion Morgan thing, you know, they famously, both of them famously believed in removing layers of process, right? You know, in trusting engineers to make decisions. And that whole thing with the, you know, with the moment where they were dealing with the fact that the pushrods were bending, right? There's a really interesting story hung on that. So that they couldn't get, over and over again, they were having problems with the pushrods literally flexing under the load as the cam lobe ramped into it, right? As the, you know, accelerating the valve off the seat, yada, yada, yada. And at one point, one of the engineers looked at Mario and he was like, well, you know, okay, I think it's the load that's being shocked into it. Can we try a gentler cam profile? You know, maybe not hit the thing with as much instant force immediately. And Mario was like, no, it won't make the power. It won't make the power we need, yada, yada, yada. And he's apparently like the next week or that month or whatever, he took this annual ski vacation for a week. And the engineer was like, okay, well, all right. And Mario leaves off on his ski vacation. And the engineer's like, well, okay, the process and the entire structure of this company and everything, the way the place is set up is, it encourages me to do this kind of thing. So we're going to try it. And they tried it. And that's when they found that extra, what was it, a couple hundred horsepower. You know, the thing ended up making like 1,024, I think, horse on the dyno corrected. And that's when they found it. And it was this counterintuitive moment of dialing the cam back a little and trusting that the people who make the decisions make the decisions. And naturally, clearly, like Mario didn't come back from vacation and be like, yeah, this is, he was like, oh, nice work. Turns out maybe I was wrong and, you know, who cares? Move on. That's really cool to me, because that wouldn't have happened in a place where you got punished for that sort of thing, no matter what the end was. Yeah.
Yep. That's the culture. And to me, that's what made that thing work. And as you said, Ross, everybody bought into that. You know, the story, one of the great quotes in Jade's book was, there was a time, and maybe this is a paraphrase of what happened often, but, you know, Paul Morgan was like, okay, whatever guy you have, got a week to figure this out. That's it. 1 week. And the guy's like, it's impossible. You can't figure it out in a week. We could barely get the drawings done in a week, let alone make it. And Paul Morgan says, all right, I'll give you 7 days. And he went, all right, that I can do. And went off and did it.
Morgan, what is it? There's I got Gerse's book. We'll come back to it in a second, but Gerse's book is fantastic. There's a story in it too. The win, Morgan ends up, he knew that his guys were going to be at the pub. So he calls the pub to talk to him. Like at one point, the company had something like 150 employees and he knew the name of every one of them. And like just the fact that I've worked, we've all worked, I think, for people who don't believe that those things matter. And in the end, like, yeah, is it a critical step on the path to getting where you need to go or to producing anything or to, you know, what was it? 9 months-ing or 10 months-ing or whatever it is, an indie engine from scratch? No, but it does help if you actually make a difference in the lives of people and give a shit about who they are and their names, and right? I mean, it's important.
And what a part of the culture of Ilmore that comes through in reading the book is the black humor. And, you know, they had names and phrases for different things. And JFDI.
What was that?
Just beep, do it.
Right.
And that was kind of the Palmer. Yeah. You know, you can't do it in a week. I'll give you 7 days then.
I'll give you
JFDI.
7 days. Right. Well, who wouldn't like working for a guy where you're working in the shop and you're making this part that you know is going to go in the engine. You know, you're in England, you know it's going to go in the engine like in a day in Pennsylvania and be run at Nazareth that afternoon. And you're making this part that, you know, it's not some production part. This thing is going to be going around Nazareth in 24 hours and you're making that thing and it's done and you have it done. And Paul Morgan takes it out of your hand, jumps in his P-51 Mustang, takes off from the runway.
Airplane.
Your airplane, right.
Yeah.
Not Mustang car.
Yeah.
Gets in his World War II fighter plane, him himself, with the part in the cargo storage or between his legs or wherever you put the part. And he flies to Heathrow, gets it on the Concorde, and your part flies Concorde back to Pennsylvania, and they bolt it in the motor when they wake up while you're sleeping, and it's running the next day. I mean, yeah. How cool. I mean, you would love to work for a company like that.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, as thinking about the drivers, you know, you've got Al Unser Jr., you've got Emerson Fittipaldi, who apparently didn't like to leave the warmth of Brazil in February and March. So left pretty much the testing to Unser and to Paul Tracy to run around Nazareth Speedway with ice walls on the outside of the track. I kept thinking as I'm going through, and I'd heard this story before, and actually, I can remember actually having a conversation with Paul Tracy many years ago and him just talking a little bit about this and the whole thing of how would he keep the track warm and dry enough when there's ice on the outside and you can't get heat in the tires. And I know the idea is to be just putting mileage on the motor, but as a driver, it's hard not to drive as quickly as you can and then know at any moment in time, this motor could just go pop and put you into a ice wall.
Ice wall.
One of the funny stories is all the crew are climbing up on the snowbanks because they can't see the car on track without standing on top of a snowbank to watch the car. Like, what a bizarre world that must have been.
How it's the notion of the pressure, right? Every ounce of it, even the testing, right? Okay, we have all day and we know we can get this many miles done and we have another engine to dump in if that one pops. But even knowing that, you know, that element of pressure, the guy in the cockpit is sitting there thinking about that, or even just Tracy, like he couldn't feel his feet, whatever it was, like that. What's so compelling about this story for me is what's compelling about any motorsport story we try and pull apart, anything we talk about in the rest of life, the Elon Musk stuff, the Apollo era, the space program. It's the notion that, you know, you cannot just create pressure arbitrarily. It has to be external, right? You can make diamonds out of that sort of thing, but it's not just, you don't just put a lump of coal in a, you know, 11 billion ton hydraulic press. I mean, actually you can, but that's not the point. My metaphor is collapsing because I didn't have enough coffee this morning, but the point is those circumstances have to be organic. And if you try and create them or even just nudge them into life for the wrong reasons, you know, that's when you turn into a kind of rectum of a person or a Musk type individual or whatever you want to call it. Right. But when it's organic, it's so powerful. And everybody kind of gloms into one piece and moves in the same direction.
And again, I mean, to me, that's why it came back to, the pressure is not on to build a cool engine.
Yeah.
Pressure is on to win the Indy 500. That, like, without that big goal at the end, I don't think anybody could have done that.
No, no. And think about, like, I think, am I right that was Paul Tracy's first year at Penske?
Was it?
He had, I think.
Wow.
So I think he was the new guy.
Yeah.
And so
actually he'd run before the previous year had done some races, I think. Yeah. But Al Unser Jr. was his first year at Penske.
Wow. Yeah. Didn't realize that. So those guys are like, as drivers, they're, you know, I'm driving for Roger Penske and they're going to give me this engine and it's probably going to blow up. I've seen like 10 of them blow up. This one's definitely going to blow up.
Yeah.
But
think about
that. I got to do it.
Think about that. There's a story. So apparently Penske told, they're at some charity softball game for Indy drivers. And Penske told Al, you know, told him about the motor. And at that point, still almost nobody knew about it. And he was like, well, I've got this motor and I've got this thing. It was going to happen. And Al was apparently like, okay, so driving for Penske and that engine. And it sounds really cool and amazing. And you think about like who would say no to driving for Roger at Indy? Who would say no to literally any version of that idea or sentence? And then the fact that the guy is basically like, it could all go terribly wrong or it could go terribly right. And at that point in your career, like what that must have felt like. Can either one of you, not that specific moment, but can either one of you remember moments? Do you have moments in your career, teams you've been a part of, races you've been a part of, where that feeling of landmark pressure, something is happening, something is swelling, this is real, it's a thing, and we all understand it. How common is that? Do you get a lot of them? You're both making faces.
Not at that level. I've never been at that level. I've never been. I mean, I guess I'm really lucky to have run at those types of levels that makes me appreciate what that must have been like, what Penske did. You know, I've never been involved in that type of a program. I think that number of people that have is maybe this is the only people that have, the people that did this program, the only ones that have been involved in something like that. But I've run close enough to that level, and I've run against Penske, and I've, you know, run with those guys to comprehend what that must have really been like. Cause it's like being, I don't know, pick your sport. It's like being the top, NFL, one of the top 10 NFL quarterbacks and having somebody come in there and double your stats. It's like, how can that happen? You know, like they were saying, when they first ran the motor and it made 30 more horsepower than the normal ones, they were like, oh, we win the Indy 500 easy with 30 more horsepower. And Roger's like, no, we need 100 more horsepower. I mean, they weren't just going to like eke out a little bit better engine. This thing was ridiculous.
And Sam, I was thinking about your question. I'm going, I think I'm a little bit like Jeff. Is I've been close to it, so I can recognize it. But my pressure has been, you know, there's that spectrum. And like on one end of the spectrum, there was this program with sounds like almost unlimited budget and people like the right people, all that kind of stuff. I was the opposite end where I had the pressure of trying to do something with no money whatsoever. So it was like the opposite end of that kind of a thing. So, so different kind of a thing. But the part of the pressure was, how do we do this whole thing without anybody knowing about it? And that is how they manage that is, you know, you've talked about it in many ways, but just to get people to, I don't know of another program in motorsport that has had this big an impact on the sport that was kept a secret like this for so long. I don't know of any other one like that.
I thought was interesting is they kept it so secret. But at some stage, they had to call in the USAC officials.
Yeah.
And actually invited them in to look at the motor and look at the rule book and compare the two and go, because it was legal. It was totally legal. But they, you know, that's always a hard thing, even on much smaller scale. You know, you're doing something that you think is legal. You read the rules, you think it's legal. And then the question always becomes, do we just do it? And if they find it or question it, pull out the rule book and say it's legal? Or do we, you know, it's, what is it? Ask for forgiveness rather than permission. And so there's that, you have to debate that, right? That was a big decision. Do we just show up at Indy with this thing? And USAC goes, no. and you go, no, but it's legal. And they go, we don't care. You're not going to, you can't run it this year. Then you're really screwed. Or do you bring USAC in? And then always the problem is at that point, when I've done this, your fear is it's easy just to say no. So you go to the rules makers and you say, here, we're going to do this. This is legal, right? And it's just easy for them just to say no, because they get in a lot less trouble. They don't have to defend it. They don't have to have people, the other competitors yelling at them because how did you allow this? You just say, no, that's not legal. And they go away. But they had to, I think that must have been a really hard decision. Like, how do we deal with USAC on this? And Jade talks about it a little bit in the book, but I'd be interested to know how they grappled with that, because they went in and showed it to them.
But correct me if I'm wrong, that point was at least 6 months into the process. Like,
it was deep.
It was like if the USAC had come in and said, no, you can't run this
right.
thing. Think of all that work and all that money that was spent at that point. Wow. That's the risk they were willing to take going into this thing. And you know, there were all sorts of other tough decisions along the way. And it's, I find that part of it interesting, how you can take these people who are way overworked, over pressured, and put them into situations where they've got to make those kind of tough decisions. And from the sounds of it, they made pretty much all the right decisions.
What a group. I like the story about, so they're running the Indy 500 and Paul Tracy comes by and smoke's coming out the back of the thing early in the race. And they're like, uh-oh, you know, because they had had some apparently oil control ring problems in the motors that they had built for the race, basically. And one of the engines had some problem and they weren't sure whether the race engines had those same batch of oil control rings, and they went and did carburation day and they were okay. So they decided to keep the run the same engines. And then Tracy goes out and suddenly smoke starts coming out the back, oil, like, oh man, these rings were bad in the race engines. All three engines are going to fail and we're not going to win this race. So Tracy's car goes back to Gasoline Alley and the guys, I think Paul Morgan was there, a couple mechanics, and they start tearing this Tracy's car apart to find out what happened. Not like they could change the oil rings in Emo's and Allison Jr.'s car, but they wanted to know. Turns out it was as they take this car apart, and now it's halfway through the race or a little more, they find that it's a bearing in the turbo that had gone and allowed oil to go into the turbo and burn and smoke. And they were all like super relieved that it wasn't the rings for the other two cars, but that's the effort that they were giving, like, tear the car apart because we got to know right now.
So a turbo that I'm assuming that it's a turbo that they bought off the shelf and, you know, wasn't some trick Gilmore thing, but the other part that was fascinating in the whole story, all of this stuff happens and everything. And the Indy 500, really, it's coming down to a fuel mileage thing and race strategy. Like, in the end, you know, the way the yellows worked and everything else, you know, it could have turned out very, very differently and become a fuel mileage thing that had nothing to do with the power that this motor was putting out. So the good news is that racing is racing, and there's always some weird thing that happens. So.
And it finished under yellow, and Al Jr. was driving around going, we don't know how this thing runs at park throttle. Yeah. We don't know if it'll keep running. It could just stop. Yeah. We don't know if it has some weird harmonic and it'll just vibrate so bad under yellow that it'll break. And he there are some quotes from him, like, he was super nervous because he had to go do whatever, 5 laps under yellow, and he had no idea how this thing was going to run.
I think what you came back to, Ross, you know, you mentioned at one point, you said some version of the whole that's racing thing, but that's what's so at the core of this story, and is probably as good a note to end on as any. That's what's so great about this for me, is that it, you know, the whole reason that everybody pulled together and did this. And the whole reason that people kept showing up and they stayed until 3 or 5 in the morning, whatever it was. And the whole reason, you know, they pulled the engine apart to do that with Emma's car. The whole reason all that stuff happened was because there was this agreed understanding, this silent, just unspoken thing where it's like, yeah, these things matter. And it's motorsport in general. You go to a racetrack, it's the reason people don't mind. I mean, from track days to solo stuff, all the way up to Indy and Le Mans, you show up at 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning, whatever it is, and everybody knows they have the same feeling. And I don't know if it changes when you're doing it for a living professionally, when you've been doing it forever, when it's just another day on the job. But from what you guys have said and talking to you, burning through all of these things we talk about on these episodes, I gather that it, you know, it turns into a job, but it's still, there's still that piece of it. And the fact that that unspoken piece was there, and the fact that it's like, does this happen in tennis? Maybe. I don't know. Does it happen in like professional pickleball? But it happens in this, and we all know why, and we don't need to pull apart why, because it just, it's the feeling. And that's so, so good. I have one more question before we wrap this up. Ross, you touched on this. What did it sound like? It was a big motor. It was a big moment. Motor turning a lot of R's. Like how did it, was it throaty? Was it like snarly or chesty? Or TV, the tape doesn't give any suggestion.
The best way to describe it, that is, you listen to, you know, a high revving Ilmor or Ford Cosworth at the time, those, you know, the purpose-built race engines, sort of that high revving, high pitch sound. And then you take the big American, you know, the Corvette motor, in the IMSA or something like that. And it's in between those two. It was sort of a more refined sounding of that big blasting Corvette motor. So I'd never heard anything else like that. And to this day, I'm not sure. And I can still kind of remember the sound of it, but I don't know if I've ever heard another motor that sounded like that.
That's so cool.
I wonder where those things are now.
I don't know. Like, you know, to me, the interesting part was that, you know, USAC afterwards the race, they said that next year they're going to lower the boost a little bit. And then, you know, a couple months later, Tony George comes along and says, I'm starting a new series called the Indy Racing League, and all those motors, like, you can't come back with that motor. And one of the fascinating things about Jade's book is there's this quote from Roger Penske that says, you know, because Penske's upset that he can't run it a second year. And Penske says, Tony George needs the decide whether he wants to be a track owner or a series owner or whatever. And I'm kind of like, Roger, what are you today?
Guy who owns the Speedway. Yeah. Right. So, okay. So that's about all we have time for. If you feel like diving deeper into this story, you should totally grab a copy of Jade Gerst's book. It's called Beast, the Top Secret Penske Ilmor Engine that shocked the racing world of the Indy 500. It's been out for several years. It's a great read. The research and the reporting in it is staggering. He talked to everybody. And there's so much more that we didn't share here. Much of the information in this episode came from that book. Jade's a friend of the show. He's a lovely guy. You should check it out. We also consulted Carl Ludvigsen's just deeply rad book, I'm a nerd. It's called Classic Racing Engines, which goes into 50 of the greatest motorsport power units, as the British say, from the 20th century, breaks them all down, just gets all geek about geometry and parts and how they all fit together to make machines that change the world. As always, if you get a chance, we really do appreciate you taking the time to give our show a rating or a follow. Check it out on our Patreon. Support really keeps us going. But other than that, that's all we have. So tune in next time when our next episode will be on, what is it? Oh, yeah. It's that time when Jeff was a robot who went back in time from this apocalyptic future to find our producer, Mike, who's this scraggly kid off the streets who rode like dirt bikes and stuff around Los Angeles, because Mike was going to be like really important to this resistance and the war against the machines in the future. And later they met up with Ross, who had broken free from psychiatric care. And there was this melty kind of liquid metal policeman guy who was secretly also a robot from the future who kept trying to harsh their buds and kill them very dead. It was kind of complicated. It all turned out fine in the end. Anyway, I guess the point is, in racing, there's no fate but what you make. And that's our show. We hope you liked it. We'll be back. Thanks for listening.
Have fun.
Have fun.